Okay, here we go.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Welcome to the show. Today on Two Boomer Babes, death-defying decisions at a storm-ravaged hospital in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Next, preventing strokes and heart disease. What do those new blood pressure numbers really mean? Then, an award-winning jazz vocalist shares her love of song and cooking. Find out why nice girls don't stay for breakfast. Plus, secrets and lies, how telling the truth can change our lives. And we'll shoot the breeze about genealogical travel adventures. Hurricane Katrina was one of the five deadliest hurricanes to hit the United States. The hospitals were not prepared for the gravity of the storm. The conditions at Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans were critical. No electricity, intense heat, rising floodwaters, and unsanitary conditions. They were so desperate that more than 20 patients died after receiving lethal injections by healthcare professionals. To add insult to injury, there were false rumors that martial law had been imposed, which left hundreds of very sick people marooned at the hospital.
Sherry Fink is a physician and an investigative reporter who reconstructs the events in Memorial Medical Center and its aftermath in her book, 5 Days at Memorial. She describes the moral dilemmas that arise when systems fail and infrastructure breaks down and reveals just how ill-prepared we are for the impact of future large-scale disasters. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So, Sherry, set the scene for us. Can you sort of quickly take us through what was happening at Memorial Hospital when Katrina hit?
Sure. Memorial Medical Center was built originally in 1926. It was a community hospital that was very well regarded in the city. And in fact, it was a place where people came to weather the storms that would often head toward the city. But it was situated 3 feet below sea level in a city that we now know very well is like a bowl, but beneath the sea level. And when people came there, there were about 2,000 people who took shelter when the storm was approaching. And that was about 250 patients, but then a lot of their family members, staff, family members, even pets of the staff were allowed to come to help the staff be able to feel that they could come for the storm and not leave their pets behind. So you had a lot of beings in this hospital when the storm hit. It was probably scary to be there at the time, and there was some window breakage, but pretty much that passed, and the hospital was on backup power. The city power had failed, and there was a vulnerability, which I've since learned is very common in American hospitals, which is that the backup power systems often aren't designed to run the air conditioning or the heating, in whichever case it may be. In this case, it was very hot. It was summer in New Orleans, so it quickly became hot, but they were still able to provide patient care with that backup power. Well, then what really destroyed New Orleans was the flooding when the levees failed. That water reached the hospital about a day later. Early Monday morning, the storm hits. Early Tuesday morning, the flooding starts, and the leaders of this hospital realized we have to get everyone out because they knew they had another vulnerability, which I've since learned a lot of American hospitals in flood zones have, which is that the backup power system had circuits and transfer switches below flood level. So they knew if the water raised to a certain point, they would lose all power. And so they quickly began trying to get people out. But with 250 patients, helicopters would arrive, but they were small. They could take one or two patients, and there were 250 to get out. So that first moral or ethical dilemma was, who do you save first when you know that all power is going to fail?
Well, Sherry, you talk about how the triage method at Memorial played a key role in the deaths of some patients. Can you tell us about that?
So very early on, when they were thinking about who to get out, they decided that they would take the babies in the neonatal ICU, these very sick babies who were fragile and dependent on electricity. They also got the intensive care unit adult patients out quickly because, again, for similar reasons. And they got some of the more ambulatory patients who could walk because they had some couple of National Guard trucks that showed up before the water got too high. But they also made this very, what turned out to be, you know, consequential decision at that point, which was to designate a certain group of patients who would go last. And they chose to designate the patients who had, quote, do not resuscitate orders to go last. And I asked them why this was, because those were some of the sickest patients, some of the patients who relied on a lot of electrical equipment or who were more fragile. But they thought, well, if somebody elects a DNR order, which really just means, you know, don't try to restart my heart if it stops, don't put me on a ventilator, if I stop breathing, things that a lot of people, for various reasons, might choose to not want it when they make their end-of-life planning ahead, you know, making those plans. But in this case, the doctor sort of took that one step further and said, well, if they don't want extraordinary means to prolong their lives, they probably wouldn't want to be rescued in advance of other people. But there's nothing, of course, in the orders that say this. And in other cases, it was a value judgment where they said, well, these people might be more toward the end of their lives, and other people have more life left to live, so we'll prioritize them first.
So, Sherry, are you saying that this triage method was not part of the evacuation plan, that they kind of made that up?
Yes, exactly. And that was one of the things that I found in studying this case, which is that we don't often think of these things in advance, but we really should, and we really should have a wider conversation about it, just like we are right now, where people in the general public can think about these things and weigh in on how should we make these decisions? That this isn't the only time that we would see them in emergencies. There are other situations where these come up. For example, transplant organs are pretty scarce, but we have a more inclusive process, committees that include members of the general public that designate how that prioritization should go. In this case, it was done ad hoc, and these poor health professionals trapped in this situation by no fault of their own just really made the best choice that they felt that they could. The problem was it wasn't really communicated, and family members panicked. They started to see other sick patients being rescued. They said, why is my mom not being taken out? You said she was really sick and she would go out with the first group. Why is she being held behind? And so slowly that information kind of trickled out, and it caused a lot of panic, and people didn't understand it.
Okay, so how did the hospital reach that unimaginable point where healthcare professionals were actually euthanizing patients? I mean, how did they get to that point?
Yes, and it happened so quickly, too, which is really the shocking part of this. But so the power did fail, and early Monday morning storm hits, early Tuesday storm floodwaters rise, early Wednesday all power fails in the hospital, all the backup power fails, generators go out, and these very sick people are still in the hospital. There were patients in a long-term acute care unit, separately owned, leased unit, where all the people, the vast majority of the people who required ventilators to help them breathe, they had not been prioritized in that first bunch. Most of them were elderly with many problems, many medical problems. So suddenly you had a really horrific situation where the tools of modern medicine were no longer available to these caring healthcare providers. And also you had the rumors of violence and real fears coming in to this hospital where some of the health professionals literally feared for their own lives and they were trying to get out. Some boats came, wonderful, you know, part of the positive side of the story is how wonderful and creative people can be and what really saved lives in this situation were these kind of ad hoc responses where someone from the swamps of western Louisiana drove in with their swamp boat and found their way to the hospital, launched their boat in the floodwaters, and started pulling people out, mostly the family members, the staff, out that way by water, over water in the boats. And then you had the helicopters coming. But, basically by that Thursday morning, there was a feeling among the staff that we wouldn't save everyone. Some people had started to die already, and that's when this discussion started happening. Well, at that point, they were euthanizing the pets. They didn't see a way that the pets would get out. Eventually, they were able to get them out on boats, but at that moment, they didn't see that.
And when you say they, who are you talking about? I mean, was this a group of doctors and nurses? Did you have an ad hoc committee? How did that work?
Well, one of the problems here, you know, when you think of preparedness and response to disasters, you've got the whole infrastructure level, the government, you know, the quality of your hospital's building. Then you've got the organizational level, the leadership of an institution. And then you've got the individual choices. And in this case, that leadership structure broke down quite a bit. And so it really was sort of ad hoc decision-making on the part of people with initiative, physicians, nurses, people who had taken initiative and felt like in the absence of real leadership, that they would make some choices. So it really was individuals making these decisions. And some health professionals really described this decision to medicate the patients differently. Many of them spoke of intentional hastening of death. Others insist we were just giving comfort medicines. And then it became, and the whole second half of 5 days at Memorial became this question of how do we adjudicate these decisions in the face of these terrible conditions? And how do we sort of ferret out what is mercy and what is ethical, you know, comforting of someone to what is crossing the line into intentional hastening of death and euthanasia, which is illegal. And that's, I think, a really very fascinating part of the whole story, too.
Were there repercussions for the doctors or the nurses or whomever that intentionally euthanized patients?
Well, the two physicians who spoke with me and who were very honest about their own actions and who did say that they had intentionally hastened death, one of them has since died. He had bad cancer. He was never arrested or anything like that. Another one was investigated after my article came out, but the coroner decided that even though this doctor thought that he killed a patient, the coroner couldn't prove it, and so therefore he would not call it a homicide, and so the local prosecutor decided not to pursue that case. But that came after there were arrests of three healthcare providers, a doctor and two nurses, who insisted that they were innocent. They never said that they had intentionally hastened death. They insisted that they were innocent of murder, but they were arrested on accusations of second-degree murder. There was a grand jury process, and the public in New Orleans came out very much in favor of the health professionals. There was a dedicated public relations campaign on behalf of these healthcare providers that really spread the message, which was well received, which is these people stayed, they tried their best, and therefore we shouldn't put them in jail. And what kind of a message would that send to other health professionals who would work in disasters? So there was an active disagreement about that even within the hospital at the time, let alone after the events when sort of the local society and leadership and coroners had to make these difficult decisions of what to call this. Was this homicide? Was it murder? Was it mercy? And what should happen to the health professionals involved?
We're speaking with Dr. Sherry Fink, who chronicles the horrific events that occurred at Memorial Hospital in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina and explores what we can learn from it. Her book is called 5 Days at Memorial. So, Sherry, just to back up a little bit, you had mentioned that patients were taken off, ventilators, obviously, because the backup power completely failed. Wouldn't they be suffering? I can only imagine someone gasping for breath.
Well, those patients had died before this decision to medicate patients took place. So what happened with those patients, it was horrific. They hand-bagged them, tried to keep the oxygen and other gases to go into their lungs as long as they could by hand, by, pumping like the air into their lungs manually. Anybody who's seen one of those ER shows know what I'm talking about, sort of manually ventilating somebody. But that's only so effective. And so they were able to save, I think it was 3 or 4 of the 7 patients who were still in the hospital when the power failed, who relied on ventilators. They got them out on helicopters, but the others died, and they died very soon. The health professionals didn't keep on with those efforts for very many hours because they felt that it wasn't effective and that the patients weren't making it. So they called off those efforts. There was also real confusion about whether there was enough oxygen. And in at least one case, the nurse was told to stop ventilating this patient by hand because there was no oxygen left. It turned out that wasn't true. It really highlights this need and the difficulty of what's called situational awareness within an organization.
Have hospitals learned anything from this horrific experience? Are they any better prepared for disaster since Katrina?
This is exactly what I'm talking about. So this need to figure out how to do this better on an organizational level and on an individual level. And I think what more recent examples have shown us, for example, Superstorm Sandy in the Northeast, is that we have a long way to go. We have really tremendous vulnerabilities in our healthcare system as it stands. And this is recognized. And the federal government, in fact, just put out some proposals for new requirements for hospitals, nursing homes, other health providers to have more more realistic emergency plans, to have emergency plans at all, because some of them didn't, and to strengthen the backup power systems, to really have an analysis of risks and hazards and how these organizations can do better.
Do you see big improvements happening?
I see that, unfortunately, the exact opposite is happening in terms of funding. The funds going to, particularly federal funds, there were some wonderful programs that have been initiated to help hospitals and nursing homes get there. And unfortunately, because of budget restrictions and choices, those funding programs have been cut and cut and cut every year. And the problem with preparedness is you can't just make an investment and then say, okay, we've funded them for, you know, to have more portable ventilators and that's it. No, you know, preparedness is an ongoing process. You always have to be preparing. You always have to be training your staff. If you don't practice something, then you can't do it in an emergency. It's just like a sport. You got to practice before you perform. And we need to think about the consequences. This is why I wrote 5 Days at Memorial. If you walk through those 5 days in that hospital, you will understand the stakes if we don't invest more in preparedness. And so that's really the message.
Dr. Sherry Fink, author of 5 Days at Memorial, thank you so much for speaking with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you, Boomer Babes.
Did you know that someone has a heart attack every 34 seconds?
And someone dies of a heart attack every 33 seconds? Which just hearing this makes my blood pressure go up.
Heart disease is the nation's number one killer and kills more people than all cancers combined every year.
Joining us to discuss how we can proactively attack the culprits that cause heart conditions is Dr. Jonathan Altshuler, director of the Cardiac Catheterization Lab at Anne Arundel Medical Center in Annapolis, Maryland. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, we know that high blood pressure is certainly not a good thing. I mean, it's one of the leading causes of heart disease. But it's been really confusing because the guidelines for what constitutes normal blood pressure were recently changed. So can you tell us about these changes? Enlighten us.
The recent changes have slightly liberalized what is considered to be normal blood pressure. And you know, I think it's a bit controversial, but in general, you know, the upper limits of normal are now the top number, systolic pressure of 140 and a diastolic pressure under 90.
Do these numbers differ for men and women, or should they be about the same?
I think really they should be the same. I think the impact and risk of blood pressure on cardiovascular disease begins to become more prominent in women a little bit later than in life than in men because of the protective effect of, you know, endogenous estrogen. But I think for the most part, the guidelines and numbers we're trying to achieve should be relatively similar.
Well, you know, I know blood pressure, at least mine, can fluctuate greatly, you know, because I have one of those in-home, at-home machines. Yeah. And if I can take it when I'm very relaxed, it's very normal. But if I'm, like, returning from the dentist or some harrowing other experience, it can go way up. I mean, is that normal to fluctuate like that?
Yeah, it's completely normal. And your blood pressure, even people who are normotensive, have normal blood pressure, you know, there will be significant variations in fluctuation during a day based on all sorts of things. And you bring up a point which I think contributes to some of the difficulty in management. You know, you have some patients who are taking their blood pressures multiple times a day, and it can take on a life of its own. So I think in-home blood pressure monitoring has its place, but you know, I really try to discourage patients from taking their pressure more than once or twice a week.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that, especially if you've got that white coat syndrome, which I have.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, what about the guidelines for blood pressure medication? Have those changed along with the change in what's considered the upper normal?
Not really. I think we have, for a number of years, used what's called a stepwise approach for the management of high blood pressure. And so, you know, the initial treatment choice, if somebody doesn't respond to diet and exercise, and I think it's important to say that that's always an option for some people, if that is not feasible or there is not a response, then generally speaking, the at least in my practice, your first-line treatment is either what's called an ACE inhibitor or a diuretic.
Okay, doctor, what are the other leading causes of heart disease and stroke? I mean, obviously smoking, but beyond.
Blood pressure, cholesterol levels, the presence or absence of smoking, sedentary lifestyle, obesity, and diabetes are the major ones.
Okay, so if we want to be proactive and really do something to prevent and control heart disease, what's the best thing to do?
Well, there are sort of, I think, two general approaches. There is lifestyle management and then medication or pharmacological manipulation of certain risk factors. Both are extremely important and have the potential to allow for significant risk reduction. So with the former, obviously diminishing salt in the diet, diminishing trans fats, trying to exercise regularly, those things can have a very significant impact on risk reduction.
All those things that aren't fun.
Exactly.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with cardiologist Dr. Jonathan Altshuler about what we can do to prevent strokes and heart disease.
You had touched on aspirin, and I really want to ask you about that. What about taking a daily baby aspirin?
The guidelines and recommendations are aspirin use for men between the age of 45 and 79, and women 55 to 79. The caveat always is the benefits that are available for cardiovascular risk reduction have to be balanced individually with the potential risk of taking aspirin.
Okay, we also hear a lot about fish oil. What about that?
Well, in reality, the data for fish oil is not very good. There have been a number of studies now that have been published that really show, in terms of hard endpoints, which are really, you know, diminishing event rates in patients, that they're not particularly better than placebo. So I'm not a big fish oil user in my practice. Now, you know, there may be some other non-cardiovascular benefits. I mean, there's some question as to the impact in Alzheimer's disease and so forth. But while it can certainly help to lower some of the numbers that we look at, triglycerides in particularly, in terms of actual reduction in events, fish oil has not been proven to be beneficial.
Interesting. Okay, let's switch gears a bit and just talk about the signs of heart trouble, because we hear so much that they're so different between men and women. Can you tell us the differences?
Sure. I think that certainly discomfort within the chest is the hallmark. Classically, the discomfort occurs with exertion and goes away with rest. That discomfort can sometimes simply be in the shoulder, the jaw, the back, the neck, either arm. I've seen people that have discomfort in their elbows. But again, the hallmark is discomfort that occurs with exertion and goes away with rest. Now, for reasons that are not entirely clear, women tend to have less typical symptoms. So their pain may not be exertional. It may not be the classic pressure, heavy, tight, squeezing, burning sensation that you typically hear of. So I think the story, when I'm seeing a patient, specifically a woman, the ability to detect classic aspects of symptoms are not as reassuring in terms of trying to make a decision whether you think those symptoms are heart-related.
And real quickly, doctor,
yes.
If we think we are having a heart attack and we're not near a hospital, should the first thing that we do be pop a baby aspirin, or is that helpful?
Yeah, I think actually at that point you can take 324 milligrams of aspirin. I think the other thing that you need to, that we are trying very hard to get across to our communities are, aside from that, the very first thing you should do is call 911.
Right.
And, you know, unfortunately, too many people sit around and wait. Other people drive themselves. And I've unfortunately been involved in some, you know, some disasters related to that. So, yeah, taking an aspirin is a good thing, but really calling 911, if we get patients quickly, we can do very, very positive things. But if we get patients late, our ability to impact outcome is really negatively impacted.
And finally, there's a great national campaign out there called the National Million Hearts Campaign, which has a goal of preventing 1 million heart attacks by 2017. Can you give us the website?
Sure. I think if you Google Million Hearts, you can get it. It's, you know, so this is a national initiative that was started in 2011. And the nice thing about it is that it is trying to enlist not only practitioners, but health systems, communities, companies within the public sector who are involved in healthcare, and then a lot of private sector interests who also, you know, can contribute to trying to achieve this goal. So, yeah, it's a goal of diminishing by 1 million both heart attack and stroke.
Dr. Jonathan Altshuler, cardiologist and director of the Cardiac Catheterization Lab at Anne Arundel Medical Center in Annapolis, Maryland, thank you so much for sharing this really important information with the Two Boomer Babes.
Happy to be here.
Up next, an award-winning singer-songwriter and the launch of Java Jive Jazz for Foodies. Stay with us.
Our next guest is one of our favorite Boomer Babes. She's an award-winning jazz vocalist and a founding member of the Manhattan Transfer, a group which launched onto the music scene in the 1970s, gained a cult-like following, and played before crowds of thousands in sold-out venues.
Now, some 40-plus years later, this rock star has relaunched big time with her soon-to-be-released solo CD and cookbook, Java Jive Jazz for Foodies, which combines her love for jazz with her passion for food, which is right up our alley. Erin Dickens joins us in our studios. Welcome, Erin.
Hi, girls. How are you?
We're wonderful. I'm better now that you're here. So, Erin, you really have, this is such a cool midlife career story. I mean, you have rebooted, you've jump-started your musical career, and you've wrapped it all up with your passion for food. What on earth gave you the gumption to tackle this enormous project?
It's huge, isn't it?
Huge!
I do wonder about myself from time to time.
Yeah. Are you seeing a psychiatrist?
I should be. I should have one on staff.
You should.
We know a few we can recommend, Erin.
Yes. This is good.
We have them on speed dial.
That's great. Well, food has been such a big part of my life, and it started out back in the day with the Manhattan Transfer. We used to cook, and at all of our rehearsals and Sunday mornings, we used to make Italian pastry called Zeppola and thick black coffee, and everybody, cook these wonderful pastries, and then we'd sing for hours. And so many musicians are into food. In fact, Tim Hauser, who you interviewed last year from Manhattan Transfer, is launching a company called I Made Sauce, and he has a line of spaghetti sauces coming out. He's just about to do his Kickstarter campaign and get that going. And then you've got your good friend, Paul Cullen, who
Absolutely. I'm
dying to meet.
Yes.
From Bad Company.
Bad Company.
Yeah.
Well, you rock stars finally figured out you need to eat.
You got to eat.
Hey,
you got to eat.
Hey, you know? Very important.
Yeah.
Well, Erin, we understand that you're really breaking it. I got that from Erin, actually, that lingo. And this is the first time your CD, Java Jive, is going to be heard in the good old USA right here on this show.
Right
on Two Boomer Babes.
Hey. You're breaking this record, baby.
We're breaking it.
You're breaking it.
I'm going to wow my kids with that one. But tell us about the CD. Why the title?
Oh, well, when we had the idea of combining food with music, I thought, well, what better song to lead with than Java Jive? Because I have such fond memories of cooking with the Transfer back then. It was like one of those moments like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, and they're hanging around and they have an idea for a song. And then Judy says, oh, my dad has sheet music in the attic. We could make a show. And then they have a show. It was sort of like that. I called Tim Hauser and he said, I'd love to sing on it. And Tim called Marty and Marty called Gene. And before I knew it, we had a show.
So let's hear a little bit from Java Jive.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea, the Java and me. A cup. I love Java, sweet and hot. Whoops, missed Ajinomoto, I'm a coffee pot. Shoot me the pot, I'll pour you a shot. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup. Oh, slip me a slug.
So, Aaron, tell us about the song Java Jive, and who else, who are the other, those sexy guys on there with you?
Oh, those are my Mantran boys.
Your Mantrans.
My Mantrans.
You might have to explain that one, Aaron.
Well, these are the founding members of Manhattan Transfer, missing only one member who we lost last year, Pat Rosalia. But Marty Nelson wrote a beautiful arrangement. Tim Hauser did the sort of duet solo-y kind of things, and Gene Pistilli. And we had, I tell you, it was 40 years has passed since we sang together. And it was like magic. It was like it was yesterday. It was something else.
That is so cool. Wow. And Java Jive was really one of your big hits, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the first things we learned. And it remains to this day one of the most requested Manhattan Transfer songs of all time.
So. You know, Aaron, I would imagine that making a CD these days is a lot harder and a lot more expensive than it used to be. But you did something so creative. You used Kickstarter.
We did.
Tell us what that is and how that even works.
It's a tough process. You know, I hate asking for help. I think everybody hates asking for help, but costs are prohibitive. Record companies no longer pay for the cost to record things. And so we put out there online what we wanted to do, which was to create a CD with a cookbook to come together with my release of my new line of herbal seasoning salts called Sizzle and Swing, and put it up there on Kickstarter, which is an online website devoted to artists raising money. And
you met your goal,
And
understand.
We met our goal,
hey.
Which was a big deal, with 2 minutes to spare, $10 over. Woohoo!
Oh, that is so cool. And we babes are thrilled because we helped sponsor your Kickstarter.
You did.
All $5
yes,
of us.
Yes, it was. We put it all in. Now, Aaron, you rap with your music. You rap these recipes. You pair them.
Right.
And I know there are just some really great stories, and we want to ask you about a couple of them. So with Java Jive, what did you pair?
I paired the Zapala. The Zapala that we cooked so many years ago. And it's fabulous. And you need a cup of coffee that's so strong the spoon stands up.
Ooh,
you know,
I love that.
Lots of sugar and ricotta cheese. And it's basically fried dough. I mean, come on.
What could be better?
I know. Rolled around in sugar. And it's a good thing.
Okay, Aaron, I was really taken by your song, Nice Girls Don't Stay for Breakfast. I don't have a clue what that means. But what do you pair with that one?
Well, I thought Eggs Benedict and Bloody Mary sounded pretty good, because if you got the nice girl to stay, may as well lead her down the road to ruin again, right?
Well, you might as well stay if you get to eat the stuff.
Yeah, right.
You know, why not?
Why not mimosas?
You could have mimosas.
Yeah.
We just always did Bennies and Bloodies.
Oh, Bennies and Bloodies.
Bennies and Bloodies.
B's and B's.
That helps forget the night before, too.
Oh, right. It does. Right. Barbara, how do you know?
Wait, I was supposed to go home? Oh, wait, I forgot.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how come you were there if you were a nice girl?
Yeah, good question. Don't tell my mom.
Okay. All right. And then rumor has it that you have quite a story about creme brulee, and that you even fell in love with your husband
over this
creamy concoction. How about that? Tell us about it.
He teased me with creme brulee for 4 years. He wanted to date me. I wasn't sure. He lived in Philly. I lived in Maryland. You know, one of those stories. Not together. They're not together. And he would write me, in New York, World Trade Center, eating creme brulee. And I'd be like, so finally we got together, and the first night that we actually went out as a couple, we went to a fabulous dinner party, and I made creme brulee for dessert, and he mouthed I love you across the swimming pool, and that was it. That was it.
Has he ever made it for you?
Oh, no, we don't go there.
Oh,
we don't go there.
Well, award-winning singer-songwriter Aaron Dickens, congrats on the release of your solo CD and cookbook. And we babes can't wait to listen and whip up one of your recipes. Although I think I'm going to let Kathy do the cooking and I'm going to do the eating, okay?
Barbara will sing for us.
Sounds like
God for
plan. Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a plan.
Families are wonderful, and yet they can be so complicated, especially when secrets are involved. Knowing a secret can be exciting, but it can also be a huge load to bear when deceiving those not in the know.
Jane Isay delves into the psychology of relationships, their blessings, challenges, and now how secrets can harm relationships while telling the truth can change our lives in her newly released book, Secrets and Lies. She joins us on the phone from New York. Welcome back, Jane.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you again.
Well, we just love this topic. But why are family relationships so darn complicated? I mean, you know, even with the best of families, they can be really, really messy.
I think this is the human condition. I think we all are much more interesting and complicated than Facebook gives us credit for.
Yeah.
If you look at the book of Genesis, every one of those families of the patriarchs are really complicated.
It makes it interesting, right?
Yeah, and I think that the family, it really is the survival mechanism of the human race. And it is complicated. It is rich. There is love, and there is anger, and there is sadness, and there is joy, and there is everything we're capable of feeling within the family.
It's just a brewing pot of emotion.
It is, and that is wonderful because it is emotion that keeps us alive.
Well, Jane, you write that your book was actually inspired because of your own life experiences.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, my very tall and handsome and brilliant husband of 15 years, one night at a psychiatric convention, he was a psychoanalyst, came back into the room and said, "I have something to tell you." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I'm homosexual."
Wow.
And I got to tell you, my life as I thought it was going to be disappeared before my eyes. Imagine sitting in the driver's seat of a car and somebody takes a baseball bat to the windshield. That's what happened.
Well, Jane, at the time, I mean, did you feel kind of cheated and deceived?
Oh, I felt cheated. I felt deceived. I felt that I was living a tragedy, because everything we had done, everything we put together, was not only in danger, but had been a fraud. And I was madder than hell, but I also loved this guy. And we had two children, 8 and 12, and we were in California at this meeting. We took a plane home to New York, and we sat in the back, and we cried, and we hugged each other. And by the time we landed at JFK, we decided to stay married. He loved me, and he didn't want to come out, and I loved him, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I didn't want to be a single mom with those two boys.
Jane, did you just miss the signs? I mean, did you have any idea your husband might have been gay?
I knew something was going on. I didn't know what it was. There was a point at which I felt he was a fugitive at the dining room table. His mind seemed to be elsewhere, but he was a Freudian, and the psychoanalyst said that you can cure it. He was in analysis for 9 years, trying to cure himself of this. This is a long time ago, a lot of pain and tragedy in that. And then when the analysis was over after 9 years, he realized what his true feelings were, and that's when he seemed to be not present. I asked a friend, a very wise woman, what I should do, and she said, "Tell him, let him know in every way how much you love him, and that whatever he's keeping secret, you can deal with." And it worked.
And Jane, did you tell your children that, you know,
no,
your husband was gay?
We didn't. They were 8 and 12. And he said he trusted my parenting instincts, and he said that I could make the decision. And I said, "I want them to grow up a little bit." We kept everything going in the family as if it were a regular family. The younger boy knew it. And he didn't know what it was, but years later he said, "The bottom of our family fell out that weekend you came home from California."
Wow. Wow. How perceptive.
And yeah. What about for your other son? I mean, wasn't that a very heavy burden to carry the secret around?
It was terrible. I got to tell you, I mean, I'm laughing now, and I don't mean to laugh, but keeping a secret of that intensity is a very hard thing for a person to do, and you get lonelier and lonelier and sadder and sadder, and you work double time to keep up the relationships that matter to you, but you can never talk about the thing that's in your heart. But in any event, we did it. And people say to me, "Well, did you do the right thing?" And all I can say is that these sons have come out to be wonderful men, fathers, husbands, and good sons, to my late husband and now to me. So I don't know whether we could have done it better, but we did it and it worked out.
If you just tuned in, our guest is author Jane Isay, and we are discussing revelations and lessons learned from her latest book, Secrets and Lies. Jane, over the course of a couple of years, you actually conducted dozens of interviews.
Yes.
And you heard a lot of stories, a lot of secrets.
I did.
Well, can you share with us the one, you know, where someone learned that they had a brother that they didn't know about?
Oh, that's such a wonderful story. I'd be happy to. This is a woman, we became friends. Sometimes, you know, you talk that intensely with people and they stay in your life. Her parents had divorced when she was 7, and she and her sister and mom went to live with their mom's parents, very straight-laced, fine people. And they took their mother in, her mother in, on the proviso that she never see that rat again and that she never date. So the mom stayed single, and the girls were raised, and they were told that their father had left town, that the aunts they loved had gone away. Nobody, they didn't care about the girls, and they missed their father's side of the family, but they were okay. And then after they grew up, my friend was at an aunt's, and the phone rang, and it was her father's sister who was calling this woman's aunt to say that he was dying, and should she call the girls? And she said, well, I'm right here. And they didn't get to see their father before they died, but they went to the funeral. And there they went to the funeral, and they walk into the funeral parlor, and the people part. And the girl, and my friend sees at the other side of the room a man who looks just like her father the last time she saw him, and that was her brother.
Wow.
And they hugged. They immediately loved each other to death because they had so much in common and because they loved each other. Then the crowd parted again, and in walked a very beautiful blonde lady whom my friend recognized immediately. Her father had had run a movie theater in their town, and this was the woman who took the tickets. And my friend had been sat on her lap and handed out tickets when she was a little girl. And her stepmother came and said, I hope you'll forgive me. And she said, I always loved you. You were such a beautiful blonde. And the mother said, there are a lot of beautiful blondes in that town.
Ooh, wow. Well, Jane, doesn't that sort of show, I mean, it's so hard to keep secrets. Like, eventually, you're going to be found out, don't you think? One way or another?
Well, you know, the only secrets that are not found out are ones we don't know. But in this situation, the other part of it that's so interesting is that the mom who had kept this secret, meanwhile, the aunts, they lived in the same town. The aunts followed the girls. They would go to performances and sit in the back of the theater to see the girls do their bell ringing or their singing. But the mother, when she was confronted with the fact that this family did love them and really cared about the girls, she turned 180 degrees and said, I never said anything bad about that family. And that is part of it. We deceive ourselves and we keep secrets for all kinds of reasons. Once a secret comes out, then you have a whole new set of tasks.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you say that the secret keeper really has a responsibility to heal the pain, because keeping secrets obviously causes pain to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you even begin to do this?
Well, you really have to take yourself on a long walk and gird yourself to take anger, to take disappointment, and to take a lot of rage at the lies that have covered up the secret. I found that, you know, the secret is a fact. In marriages, when somebody's having an affair, the fact is the affair, right? Bad enough. But then there are the lies that cover that fact that can go on for decades. It turns out that people are as angry about the lies, the betrayal of the lies, as they are about the fact that caused the lies. So what you have to do if your secret is found out and you want to keep up the relationship, a lot of people say, well, I'm out of here. But if you want to keep the relationship, you have to listen to the anger and just sit there, not defend yourself, say, and let the person know that their unhappiness is reasonable. And then you need to tell over time and again the circumstances that caused the act that was kept secret. Over time, we as human beings have the ability, once we understand the context, we can sometimes come to understand the person. And the worst thing you can do is say, well, now you know, I'll never discuss it again, because then there is no way to recover.
Well, and Jane, I love it when you wrote that silence and ambiguity can perpetuate the pain.
Oh.
And, you know, we so often hear how tragically that families are torn apart by incredible silence. I mean, I can't even imagine, because our families, both Barbara and mine, are so incredibly close. But these people, how do they deal with this? This is so sad.
It is so sad. But sometimes, yes, and I have it, as you know, there's a chapter in the book called If You See Something, Say Something. And that's about how when everybody knows that something terrible has happened, if they can't talk about it, they really can't stay close. Because, again, if there's something in your heart and you can't, you have to button your lip, it's really hard. On the other hand, there are times when people grow up and the brothers and the sisters, quite apart from the dinner table, begin to talk about these things, and they begin to heal together. And then there is such a relief when something like that, something bad, is talked about, because nobody enjoys the secret.
Well, Jane Isay, author of Secrets and Lives, Surviving the Truth That Change Our Lives, we've really enjoyed the conversation, and you've given us a lot of food for thought here. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes yet again.
Thank you.
Racking your brain about where to take your next vacation? Why not build a trip around some aspect of your family's genealogy? After all, where we come from says a lot about our present and just might explain a few things about those crazy relatives on Dad's side.
Travel guru Deb Stone is back with the babes to shoot the breeze about planning your next genealogical travel adventure. Welcome, Deb.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to talk to you, babes.
Hey, so is there a growing trend towards roots travel? I mean, especially among us boomers?
Yes, you know what? I think, first of all, most Americans' ancestors are immigrants from somewhere, so it's really natural to wonder about where we come from and why. But the increased interest, I think, has to do with a few things. One is actually the NBC show Who Do You Think You Are? I don't know if you know that show, the one that's traced the histories of a lot of celebrities, and they go on these personal journeys, and they reveal that many of us have these fascinating tidbits buried that deep in our past. But that's been one of the reasons for the popularity. But I also think it's retiring boomers with more time to travel that has definitely generated increased interest.
Well, I'm on Ancestry.com, and I'm just sure, I'm keep looking for my rich relatives in Ireland with the castle. I'm just sure we have one somewhere.
Well, good luck with that, huh?
Thank you.
And, you know, mine came over on the Mayflower via Russia.
She's so important.
Like detour, right?
Exactly, a little detour. So, Deb, say I'm going to, I'll pick a country, Germany, to check out the village where my grandparents came from. What's involved? How much research should I do before I set off for the old country?
Well, I think really that depends on the individual. First of all, I think it depends on whether you really enjoy doing that kind of research by yourself or whether you'd like to have assistance in doing it. But in any case, you're going to want to, of course, put in as much information as you can at one of those wonderful websites that you just mentioned. Ancestry.com, in fact, is the largest genealogy website in the world. But there are several others, such as archives.com, genealogy.com, and then RootsWeb. RootsWeb is free. The others do have charges associated with them. But really, it just depends on how much research one wants to do. You can enter all the information, as I said, and see what comes up. But if you do come to places where you are stuck or where you can't go any further, then you want to probably enlist the help of someone, a company, a tour company that could help you, or else going to one of those places like the Family History Library in Salt Lake City or the National Archives in D.C.
Well, what are these companies?
They're actually genealogy tour companies? What are they?
Yes, in fact, there's several that have sprung up in the recent years. One in particular, you know, most of them do the personalized, individualized tours, but this particular company, I've noticed, Family Tree Tours, offers not only the private tours, but group genealogy tours. So they are pre-planned tours with flexibility of taking independent day trips to explore your hometown or visit your relatives, as well as including all sorts of events and cultural types of activities. And they provide contacts for these professionals, these European heritage professionals in your ancestral hometown who meet you and escort you on your visit, as well as provide you with the family tree research help.
Wow. And gives you the key to the castle.
Absolutely.
She is such a has rose-colored glasses over there.
I do.
I've given up.
Dream on, girl.
Yeah, exactly. Really. Might as well think high, you know.
Exactly. Well, Deb, how much are these tours? Say we go with a group tour. How much can we expect to pay for this?
Well, you mentioned Germany. So, for example, the company I just mentioned, Family Tree Tours, does a Northwest Germany tour. I think it's 10 or 11 days, and it's probably in the neighborhood of about $2,500, which includes some meals. It includes internal company, country transportation, entrance fees, expert help, your hotel. Of course, your airfare over there you are responsible for. But that gives you some ideas. They also do tours to the Black Forest in Germany. And then, speaking of Ireland, they do an Irish Heritage Tour, which is close in the same amount of price range, about 10 or 11 days and about $2,300 per person.
Hmm. Oh, that sounds like such fun.
And I'm thinking these group tours, you might meet like a long-lost cousin that's looking for the same village.
Absolutely. And, these people are connecting, because they have that goal and that interest in finding out maybe where their great-great-grandfather lived, or maybe even finding their long-lost cousins.
Right. And they might own a castle, Kathy.
See? I think we ought to book it tomorrow.
I think that's absolutely perfect. Well, Deb Stone, our go-to guru, thanks so much for sharing your always fabulous travel tips with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks for having me, Gail.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
Can you think of anything else?
I'm glad other people don't remember. That's all I can say. Okay, here we go.
Yeah, really.
To listen to the entire interview, visit twoboomerbabes.com.